The Presidencies of the United States is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network.
The fate of Upper Canada depends on our being the conquerors or the conquered. Both fleets are anxiously waiting the event. British midshipman John Johnston to Jane Johnston, 23 June 1813.
Though there had already been plenty of fighting along the lake shores by mid-1813, both British and American forces in the northeast and northwest knew that naval supremacy on the Great Lakes would determine the balance of power in the region and potentially the fate of the Canadian provinces and American states. Indeed, it would only be a few more months before a key battle took place on Lake Erie, which was arguably one of, if not the most pivotal battle in the entire war. Before I get to that, though, I'd like to welcome you to the Presidencies of the United States. I'm your host, Jerry Landry. Special thanks to Brandon Eldridge of the Eldridge History YouTube channel for providing the opening quote for this episode. Eldridge History is focused on providing support for AP history students through weekly videos on various topics in U.S. history. With just a few minutes of your time, Brandon provides key information about various topics to help students succeed in AP history courses. I'll have a link to his YouTube channel on the page for this episode on my website, presidenciespodcast.com, or you can search for Eldridge History on YouTube. By the way, if you're interested, Presidencies also has a YouTube channel, so while you're subscribing to Brandon's channel, you can also hit subscribe for Presidencies Podcast, all one word.
This is Alex Hastie, the host of Ohio vs. the World, an American history podcast. On Ohio vs. the World, we'll travel back in time with the authors, historians, and even witnesses to visit the most exciting, consequential, and too often overlooked topics that have shaped America's history. There seems to be an Ohio connection to so many important moments.
When you said Ohio versus the world, we did some damage.
So join us and we'll take a deep dive to enlighten, educate, and entertain you as Ohio versus the World makes history fun again.
When last we left the fighting in the North, back in episode 4.27, the Battle of York had provided a much-needed victory for American forces. But General Henry Dearborn had been removed from command after leaving the primary U.S. naval base on the Great Lakes, Sackett's Harbor, open for a British counterattack. Before we can talk about what comes next, however, I do need to introduce you to a young U.S. naval officer who is about to play a key role in events in the Great Lakes region in 1813. Oliver Hazard Perry was born in Bristol, Rhode Island in 1785 and grew up near the sea. His father served in the Continental Navy during the Revolution, then, while Oliver was still young, quote, turned toward the sea to become an officer on small merchant coasters at first, and then transitioned to bigger ships and longer voyages. When his father took command of a U.S. naval ship in 1799, Oliver asked to join his crew as a midshipman and thus began his own naval career. After service in the Caribbean during the Quasi-War, then a couple of cruises in the Mediterranean as part of the First Barbary War, Perry would be returned to Rhode Island to serve at the Newport Shipyard, and was given command of a gunboat section in the latter part of Jefferson's presidency. He would stay close to his home state of Rhode Island until, in January 1813, quote, Perry received orders to take command of the Lake Erie Squadron as master and commander, a grade between lieutenant and captain. Unfortunately, this command meant that Perry was under Commodore Isaac Chauncey, and the two would have their fair share of disagreements. Despite Secretary of the Navy William Jones urging that naval action on Lake Erie should be given precedence over that on Lake Ontario, Chauncey had agreed with General Henry Dearborn that they should focus their efforts on Canadian targets on the Lake Ontario shore. This, however, meant that General William Henry Harrison, who was trying to retake Detroit, would be left on his own without naval support, as Chauncey did all he could to divert supplies and troops intended for the Lake Erie fleet to his own. Secretary Jones, growing frustrated when he learned what Chauncey was up to, started sending messages to Perry directly, which was a violation of naval protocol and put Perry in an awkward position, especially when Chauncey learned of this behind-the-scenes communication. In order to remedy the situation, Jones elevated Perry's rank to give him full command of U.S. naval operations on Lake Erie, but neglected to tell Chauncey. As you can imagine, dear listener, this only added fuel to the fire. After this, any goodwill that Chauncey had for Perry was gone, and the commander of the Lake Erie Squadron still needed to find men to serve aboard the ships that were being built to constitute his command. While Perry considers that one, let's find out what was happening with our old friend General William Henry Harrison. As we discussed back in episodes 4.23 and 4.24, Harrison had initially been reluctant to accept a command as a brigadier general in the regular army, as it did not allow him as much prestige and leverage in the Western theater as did his commission as a major general in the Kentucky State Militia, as well as the fact that it would necessitate his relinquishing his governorship of the Indiana Territory. However, the problems that this caused with subordinate regular army officers, as made painfully obvious by the disaster of the River Raisin Massacre, made it clear in early 1813 that he needed to move over to the regular army in order to command the proper amount of respect from any forces sent westward by the government in Washington. Thus, Harrison wanted to negotiate his terms. As noted by historian David Curtis Skaggs, he sent word to President Madison through Representative Richard M. Johnson, Democratic Republican from Kentucky, that he was willing to relinquish his post as governor if he could either be guaranteed a position as major general or, if he had to accept a commission as brigadier general, he, quote, wanted a date of rank that put him third or fourth on the list of brigadiers. Otherwise, he would continue to exercise his command as a Kentucky brevet major general. Johnson recommended to the president that Harrison be elevated to the rank of major general. On February 27, 1813, Madison submitted a nomination for Harrison to be commissioned as a major general to the Senate and for Thomas Posey to be his replacement as governor of the Indiana Territory. Harrison's commission was approved on March 1st, and Posey was confirmed 2 days later. Harrison's commission came with an appointment as the commander of the 8th Military District and a directive to launch, quote, an invasion of Western Upper Canada. Before word of this new commission came, Harrison gave orders for the construction of a new defensive position to prepare for the invasion orders that he knew were coming. As described by historian René Chartrand, quote, the construction of Fort Meigs by General William Henry Harrison's army started in February 1813. Built on a wide bluff near the Maumee River, it was originally meant to be a large temporary base and a supply depot for an intended invasion of Western Canada. It was therefore much bigger than the average frontier fort, but did not have barracks because troops assembling there were not expected to remain for very long. As explained by Skaggs, quote, the military situation at Fort Meigs became more desperate as the temperatures warmed and the ice melted. The British had already taken Detroit and started to move south with Frenchtown. Fort Meigs was the next target on the list. The new British commander leading the attack, Major General Henry Proctor, did not enjoy the same confidence of his native allies, and in particular, the Shawnee leader Tecumseh, as the late Major General Isaac Brock, who fell at the Battle of Queenston Heights, as discussed in episode 4.23. He did, like Brock, at least understand the importance of pressing the fight sooner rather than later, both to take advantage of the strategic disorder on the American side, as well as to placate their native allies who demanded action. While Tecumseh and Brock had reached a place of mutual respect, Proctor did not understand the native peoples as Brock did, and thus theirs was not an equal partnership. As Tecumseh biographer John Sugden wrote, quote, in some ways, Proctor was a prisoner of his native allies. He was expected to discipline and control them, but because their support was so essential, he could not afford to antagonize them. At times, he seemed almost afraid of the fearsome-looking fighting men who outnumbered his own troops. Still, on April 27th, the Allied forces set up their primary camp, quote, 2.5 miles below Fort Meigs, and spent the next couple of days making preparations. As they brought, quote, 5 artillery pieces into position for bombardment, General Harrison watched from inside the fort and wrote to Ohio Governor Return J. Meigs that, quote, The enemy little dream of the bitter pill I have prepared for them. Procter and Tecumseh had a 4-1 advantage in terms of men, but when the firing started on May 1st, it quickly became apparent that the American defenders of the fort were well prepared in a strong fortification. As noted by historian Walter Bornman, quote, "The projectiles they, i.e. the British, delivered, landed with mere thuds. Thanks to the design of the fort and tireless digging of Harrison's men, the British artillery rounds punched harmlessly into the dirt mounds of the fort's perimeter. Even better, instead of leaving the spent cannonballs there, quote, Harrison promptly offered a gill, half a cup, of whiskey for each round recovered, and the digging became fast and furious. Soon, the Americans were firing British cannonballs back at their attackers. Despite this turnabout, Procter counted on his advantage in terms of troops to win the day and, quote, demanded that Harrison surrender. Harrison, with his bitter pill strategy, had no intention of doing so, no matter how many cannonballs the British lobbed at them. And indeed, one American at the siege, quote, counted 1,649 discharges from the morning of the 1st to the 5th of May. No, Harrison knew something that Procter didn't. Not only was he in a strong defensible position with a reliable force, reinforcements were on the way from Fort Winchester. Meanwhile, Procter started to experience dissension in the ranks from Canadian militia who wanted to get back home in order to plant crops for the growing season, as well as native forces who were not accustomed to the inaction of siege warfare. Then, on May 5th, the American relief force, 1,400 strong, arrived. Procter realized any advantage he had was gone, and by May 9th, the siege was lifted. Despite the heavy losses suffered by the Americans, 135 killed, over 630 captured, and 188 wounded, the fort still stood in American hands, at least for now. By mid-June, the British and the native leaders were in conference at Fort Malden to plan their next attack. By this point, Procter's weaknesses were on display. Again from Sugden, quote, "A more effective leader than Procter might have reconciled the Indian and British views, but he was a poor communicator. In fact, his officers were divided, irrespective of rank, between those who did and those who did not enjoy the general's confidence." The British command was more focused on the rapid growth of American naval power on Lake Erie, while the native leaders, who were not accustomed to including naval strategy in their war plans, were focused on another attack on Fort Meigs. Ultimately, Procter sided with the native forces and agreed to a second attack on the fort once an expected battalion of British troops arrived. Unfortunately for the Allied force, at this point, quote, Fort Meigs was actually stronger than ever. It contained ample provisions and ammunition and nearly 2,000 men, most of them fit for duty. Even worse, the commander of the fort knew that the native and British forces were coming. Thus, when they took up their previous main encampment just below Fort Meigs on July 20th, the fort's defenders were ready. Harrison was not present at the time, as was known by the Allied force, but the hope was to draw him to divert his attention from his plans to retake Detroit. These hopes were soon dashed, as, quote, no one had any faith in the siege itself. The British scarcely bothered to erect batteries, and the Allied small arms fire, although sometimes heavy, was desultory and ineffective. No more than 2 or 3 defenders were wounded during the entire operation. After a failed attempt to draw out the American forces, Procter called for a retreat and redirected the Allied force on what would prove to be an ill-fated assault on Fort Stevenson, which led to the loss on the British side of 29, along with 28 missing and 44 wounded. Though compared to other battles, this was a low casualty rate. Procter was not willing to risk his men's lives for a campaign he wasn't completely bought into to begin with, and thus he ordered a retreat. Tecumseh was beside himself. He had already declared Procter unfit for his command and had told him that he should, quote, go and put on petticoats. Now, he saw that his supposed partner on the British side was quick to turn tail and run at the first sign of trouble. The alliance was on shaky grounds, and this would work to Harrison and Perry's advantage as they increasingly planned operations around Lake Erie. Perry had been steadily working to build his squadron at Presque Isle Bay in Erie, Pennsylvania since his arrival in late March, and by the last week of July, the ships were ready. He just needed folks to man them. Moreover, he needed good sailors, but the few men that Chauncey would send his way often ended up suffering from, quote, lack of training, poor discipline, and or ill health. He would ultimately end up with a force of around 585 men attached to the 10 ships in his squadron, though only around 450 to 500 would prove to be battle-ready when needed. Still, it was enough of a force that Perry decided the time had come to launch his squadron into Lake Erie. There was just one problem. The sandbar at the mouth of Presque Isle Bay that helped protect the fleet from the British sailing in also proved to be a barrier from the American squadron making their way out to the lake. Further, a British squadron led by Commander Robert Barclay had blockaded the bay for most of July. When Barclay sailed his squadron for Port Dover, Upper Canada on July 31st, ostensibly to resupply his ships, Perry and his officers saw their chance. They had devised a means based on a similar Dutch system to raise the ships over the sandbar and lower them into the lake. By mid-morning on August 3rd, the first ship was over the sandbar and stood ready to defend the others as they were brought over. The American resolve threatened to be put to the test when Barclay's ships were spotted on August 4th. Thankfully for Perry and his squadron, the British commander did not have a clear line of sight as it was hazy and thought Perry's entire squadron had already crossed into the lake. Thus, Barclay ordered his ships to withdraw, and the American ships were able to finish crossing the sandbar. With this new force now able to sail anywhere on Lake Erie, the naval advantage on that lake, and indeed the Upper Lakes in general, turned to the Americans, and Perry and General Harrison were ready to put it to good use. On August 12th, Perry ordered his squadron to set sail towards the mouth of Sandusky Bay in northern Ohio. By the 19th, General Harrison was aboard, and he, Perry, and their respective staffs held a two-day meeting to plan a joint operation. Harrison and Perry had been in communication for months exchanging information, so now that they were able to link up their forces, they intended to move without delay. Perry would use his ships, now with 130 volunteers from Harrison's force supporting the already existing crews, to scout out conditions at Fort Malden and hopefully, quote, entice Barclay's fleet into action on the lake. Then the two would launch, quote, an amphibious assault on Amherstburg around September 15th, with Harrison working while Perry was engaged with the British fleet to get his force in place for that joint operation. Perry's initial attempts to draw Barclay's fleet out at the end of August and beginning of September proved unsuccessful. But on the evening of September 9th, the British ships, quote, floated down the Detroit River into Lake Erie. Though he knew that the American force had the advantage, Barclay's hand was forced due to, quote, the want of provisions for his fleet. While, as Skaggs and Althoff outline, there were a few options available for him and British General Proctor, pursuing a naval battle was ultimately deemed the choice with the best possibility of success out of a series of bad scenarios. When the British fleet entered Lake Erie the morning of September 10th, they were soon engaged by Perry's fleet, which had been waiting at nearby Put-in Bay. The fight wasn't a guaranteed victory for the Americans, and indeed, Perry's flagship suffered such great damage that he had to transfer his command to another ship in the midst of battle. After over 3 hours of battle, the order was finally given to strike colors, and, as noted by Skaggs and Althoff, quote, the entire British flotilla was in American hands. It was one of the rare times in British history that the Royal Navy lost an entire squadron. Wanting to share the news with his colleague on shore immediately, Perry found an old envelope and wrote out the following in pencil, quote, Dear General, we have met the enemy, and they are ours. 2 ships, 2 brigs, 1 schooner, and 1 sloop. Yours with great respect and esteem, O.H. Perry. With that, American fortunes in the War on the Great Lakes had shifted, but neither Perry nor Harrison was ready to rest on their laurels. It was time to finally take the fight to the British in Canada. When word arrived behind British lines of the loss of Barclay's squadron, General Proctor, those in his command, and his native allies all scrambled to figure out their next course of action. For Proctor, he quickly came to the conclusion that both Detroit and Fort Malden were indefensible without naval support. He would have to evacuate further into Canada, and he knew that the native forces would be none too pleased, as he had promised that he would not retreat and yield territory to the Americans. Thus, he began making his preparations to withdraw British forces to the Lower Thames River in modern-day southwestern Ontario in secret. As Sugden notes, quote, "It seemed that the British general was afraid of dealing with Tecumseh." Meanwhile, some of the native warriors began to make overtures to Harrison to negotiate and possibly even join forces with the Americans against the British. Proctor's force was further diminished by Canadian militiamen who decided that, now that it was their loved ones and property in danger from an invasion, they would desert and return home to defend what was most near and dear to them. After delaying, General Proctor finally held a conference with Tecumseh and the native leaders to inform them of the situation. After evaluating the tactical situation by asking questions of Proctor and referring to a map on hand, Tecumseh finally agreed to the withdrawal on the condition that it was just to, quote, "the forks of the Thames, a place called Chatham, where the Allied force would make their stand against the Americans." Soon enough, the British and around 1,200 native warriors and their families were on the road retreating from the Detroit River further into Upper Canada. On the morning of September 27th, a British ensign still stationed below Amherstburg spotted ships carrying General Harrison and his army crossing over, bound for Canadian soil. Detroit was back in the hands of American forces by September 29th, and on October 1st, Harrison conferred with the generals under his command, as well as Captain Perry, about what course they should take to pursue Proctor and Tecumseh. They ultimately decided to carry out the pursuit by land, and Proctor's dallying meant that they would be able to catch up to the remainder of the Allied force quickly. Proctor had wasted time after the retreat began trying to determine where to make his stand against the Americans and their native allies. Upon further reflection, he felt that Chatham presented an insufficient battleground, so he put forward the idea of engaging the Americans earlier at Dolson's Farm, but Tecumseh objected to this, asserting that the original ground chosen at the forks of the Thames was much more defensible. As Proctor continued to debate the issue, Tecumseh informed him that his spies had reported back that Harrison had already reached Dolson's. Proctor then turned his attention to, quote, "a plateau behind Moraviantown." As he dallied, the limited resources of the Allies were ineffectively spread out as first one, then another order was received listing a different location to prepare for the defense. Meanwhile, the Americans drew closer, and advanced units began capturing both men and supplies. This disorder disheartened Tecumseh and those under his command, and more native warriors defected to the American side. Finally, just west of Moraviantown, Proctor readied his force to engage Harrison and his troops. When the two armies met on October 5th, the British and their native allies were severely outnumbered by the Americans and their native allies, and in 5 to 10 minutes, it was all over. Though Proctor tried to rally his troops, their heart was not in the battle, and they quickly turned in retreat. Harrison would report afterwards that 601 British and Canadian soldiers had been captured and 12 were killed on the battlefield, while the Americans lost 15 men and suffered an equal number of injured. This battle, dubbed the Battle of the Thames, would ultimately become well known due in large part to one notable casualty. No one knows exactly, and we will likely never know, how it happened. The Shawnee chief was spotted by numerous folks on the battlefield engaged in combat, but when the fighting ended, Tecumseh's was one of the lifeless bodies left in the aftermath with multiple bullet wounds and injuries. As Major Thomas Rowland wrote to a friend a few days later, quote, "Tecumseh is certainly killed. I saw it with my own eyes. It was the first time I'd seen the celebrated chief. There was something so majestic, so dignified, and yet so mild in his countenance as he lay stretched on his back on the ground where a few minutes before he had rallied his men to the fight, that while gazing on him with admiration and pity, I forgot he was a savage. He had such a countenance as I shall never forget." His body was soon desecrated by American soldiers, and General Harrison, viewing it the next day with Commodore Perry, expressed that he was, quote, "greatly vexed and mortified by what had been done." Tecumseh's final resting place is unknown, though in 1830, two Americans traveling through the area were shown by a local what was purported to be the Shawnee chief's grave, marked by, quote, "a hewn post 5 feet long. It had fallen from its place, but it still bore the remains of flaking red paint and weathered Indian characters." Despite this inauspicious end, Tecumseh's legacy would live on. His biographer, John Sugden, asserted that, quote, "among all the leaders in that brave but futile Indian revolt, Tecumseh stands out because of his astounding versatility and energy. Not only was his ambition boundless, but his eloquence made him the voice of the oppressed. His magnetism bound people to him, and he was an inspirational field commander. More than anything else, he was a man of tremendous vitality and sense of purpose. In a word, of passion." Now, though, the great Tecumseh was gone, and the native peoples who had rallied behind him would have to figure out what was next, along with his British allies. That, however, will have to be a topic that we explore on another day, for our time together is drawing to a close. Thanks again to Brandon Eldridge for providing the intro quote for this episode, and be sure to check out Eldridge History on YouTube. Special thanks to Christian of Your Podcast Pal for his audio editing work on this episode. If you'd like to enlist Christian's services for your podcast, just go to yourpodcastpal, that's all one word, .com to find out more. Our sincerest thanks also to the folks at the Colonial Music Institute at George Washington's Mount Vernon, who graciously allowed us the use of clips from Hull's Victory, as performed by David and Ginger Hildebrand, for our intro and outro music. You can find out more about the great work that the Colonial Music Institute is doing to research and share information about early American music and dance by going to mountvernon.org and typing in Colonial Music Institute in the search field. You can find links to all of these and more at my website, presidenciespodcast.com. If you'd like to keep up with what's happening on the Presidencies Podcast, I do have a monthly e-newsletter. Just go to presidencies.substack.com to sign up. If you'd like to contribute to the work of the podcast, I cannot thank you enough for your support to offset the cost of equipment, supplies, and research resources used to make Presidencies happen. If you'd like to sign up for a recurring donation, just go to patreon.com/presidencies to sign up to be a patron of the podcast. Patrons get numerous perks, including, but not limited to, access to an ad-free feed for the podcast. At the $10 a month level and up, we have a monthly call where we always have a lively conversation and patrons can ask any burning questions they have about the podcast or presidential history in general. If you'd like to do a one-time donation, I just set up an account on Buy Me a Coffee, so you can go to buymeacoffee.com/presidencies. If you'd rather not contribute monetarily right now, leaving a rating and review is a great way to show your support by telling others why they should be listening to the Presidencies podcast. For those who regularly share information about new episodes on social media, I cannot thank you enough, as word of mouth is still, even in the 21st century, the best way to get the word out there. Speaking of, if you're not connected with me on social media yet, I can be found on Facebook, Mastodon, Post, and Blue Sky as Presidencies, on the formerly known as Twitter at Presidencies89, and on Instagram and Threads at Presidencies Podcast. Feel free to send me an email at presidenciespodcast@gmail.com. With all that said, I cannot thank you enough for listening. Until next time, stay safe and healthy, be kind to one another, and take care, dear friends.
Welcome to Anthology of Heroes, the podcast that explores the most pivotal moments of history through the eyes of those who lived it. In this podcast, we don't spend our time recounting facts and dates. Instead, we follow in the footsteps of national heroes, kings, or ordinary people who lived and breathed the moments that shaped our world. We're not hemmed in by eras, borders, or religions. Instead, we seek out the tales of those who defied the odds and fought passionately for their beliefs. Whether they're right or wrong is up to you to decide. From Vercingetorix's doomed rebellion against Rome, to Osceola's unshakable war against the USA, all the way up to the inspiring Sobibor concentration camp uprising in World War II, each episode is an immersive listening experience, blending music and sound effects to really draw you into the story. Our episodes go for about 45 minutes, making them perfect for your commute, and are crafted using a wealth of historical sources, which I list on our website if you want to learn more. I'm the host, Elliot Gates, and I'm thrilled to have you joining me as we uncover history's hidden gems and illuminate the faded pages of our past. Look out for the Anthology of Heroes podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, or anywhere else you get your podcasts from.